jump right in.
Okay, so we had been talking yesterday about this fascinating principle that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wouldn't bring a takala al yidei tzaddikim, and in fact not even through their behemoths. And we tried to figure out a little bit, what does that mean? What are the parameters? What does that mean theologically? Is it saying that certain individuals reach a threshold after which it's not shaykh for them to sin anymore? Does that make sense? Or are we saying something else? And are there any halachic implications? And there are also significant lamdish implications that we indicated. So yesterday we had focused mostly, after setting that up a little bit, on the view that is most well known, although not unanimous at all, that this principle is limited to midei da'achila. And it's most well known because of prominent real estate that it has, that the Tosfos in a couple of places asserts this position, that it's all about midei da'achila, and that's how you could reconcile this idea with other sources where you do find mistakes happening and you do find averos happening through tzaddikim. So apparently it is possible, but when it comes to matters of eating, we say in a Kadosh Baruch Hu maybe takala. And we started to discuss, why should there be such a distinction? Even though Tosfos says why, because that's a bigger gnai. What does that mean practically? And similarly, Rabbeinu Tam in the Sefer HaYashar says this chiluk also. He phrased it a little differently. It's going to be niskala. We didn't understand exactly what that meant. So we started to discuss a little bit, why should achila be unique? And we talked about really two paths to that approach, which are related. One, that there is the idea that there's a timtum halev associated with achila, which is a little bit of a vague idea, because the Gemara talks about timtum halev in the context of an avera, and many associate that specifically with eating, but not everyone does. So to limit it to achila based on timtum halev works for some interpretations and not others. But there certainly is a trend that sees achila as a more significant avera than other things, and one that we have to worry about even when there isn't full das involved, and even when there are other pressures. So we mentioned the view of the Ravid that one should rather shecht an animal on Shabbos for a cholish yesh bo sakana rather than feed nevelus and treifus, if those are the two choices. And it seems to be, among other explanations, we mentioned there are a number of explanations for that position. We only touched upon some of them, but there are even more than the ones we mentioned. But that there are those who understand that achila is just something that has greater consequence even when it's done for needed reasons. I saw the Sefer Kol Sofer that he understands, just an extension of what we were saying yesterday, that the whole concept of machilu noso hakal hakal tchila, the idea the Mishnah says in Yuma, that if something needs to be eaten for pikuach nefesh reasons, we still try to keep the isser limited. We still try to go for a lower avera rather than a bigger avera, for the theoretical onesh. So there, he says that distinction is only because we're talking within different isurei achila. But if we're comparing an isur achila to another avera, so it may be the case that that other avera is preferable than the isur achila because of this factor, even if the onesh might be more chamer. So to go back to this example of chil Shabbos versus eating treif, the onesh for chil Shabbos is more chamer. Nonetheless, it's not going to carry as far as this is concerned, at least according to some perspectives. Okay, so those are some important things to keep in mind, and whether it's because of timtum halev or maybe because of the fact it becomes a part of one's body, and that's how some explain Mesilas Yesharim. Marikash is quoted saying this as well, that the fact that it becomes a part of you, that's why it's a bigger gnai. You are what you eat, but it's not necessarily something that is going to apply to other concepts. However, There are some sources that indicate differently. Probably there are many sources that indicate differently, where you could find this phrase utilized in other contexts, or you find it explained differently. So one place, for example, if you look in the Chiddush Sheharan, over here in Chulin, you saw the Chiddush Sheharan, and so how does he approach this issue of reconciling when we say it and when we don't say it?
Pshia.
Right? So that makes a significant difference. It also helps explain the whole concept. Right? That, no, it can happen that a Aveira will take place, to address our earlier question, and a Tzadik could end up doing an Aveira also. Clearly, so if he's Poshea, so then anything could happen. But what this klal means is that if he's really careful and he's not doing anything knowingly wrong or negligent, so then we could assume that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is not going to bring a takala al yado. So he uses that to explain the contradictory sources. So that position has double significance for us. One, that it helps to put it in a theological framework that we can relate to a little bit more, which in turn helps us to understand the whole yesod of what this concept means. That essentially, not that a person's past history earns them total protection, but that within an action, if you're acting responsibly, so then there's this extra protection. And that apparently the Ran doesn't assume any distinction between eating issues and other issues. This is probably the way the Al-Shech understands it also. Look at the Al-Shech in Parshas Vayikra. And here again, this is a point that's going to connect in various different ways. So the Al-Shech discusses the concept of bringing a korban for an aver b'shogeg. It's a deeply related topic. The idea that if one does something wrong, even inadvertently, so he should bring a kapara. So why is that the case? So there are various perspectives on that. And the Al-Shech discusses, among others, that shogeg isn't a pure accident. That if there is something that happened, even if you didn't do it on purpose, it still means there was some negligence. So there was some contributory role that you played. So here, it's interesting because this is kind of on the border between a mystical and a more rational idea, because you could kind of interpret it both ways. Right? You could kind of say that a person who has something bad happen through him, even if he didn't mean to do it, it's kind of an indication in the Shemayim that there's something missing, that a more purely intentioned tzaddik wouldn't have even a shogeg happen. Or it could mean even something more rational, just that lamaisa, if you're doing a veris b'shogeg, you're not as responsible as you should be. And therefore, you're not completely free of any need for a tikkun. And that's what the korban represents. Now, in that comment, the Al-Shech invokes Behemten Shel Tzadikim. And that means that that's the way he understands this concept. The two ways we just said, both the mystical and the practical or the rational, are both reasonable ways of looking at it through the Al-Shech citation here. That either it means that a tzaddik, when he reaches a certain level, so things are not going to happen to him even b'shogeg, because he doesn't deserve for them to happen. And shogeg indicates some kind of mystical liability. Or maybe it's more direct, that when somebody is fully responsible, so he's not going to end up in a situation with a takala even inadvertently. But it also seems that applying this idea through this explanation, this is not specifically about achila, this is true about aveiros in general. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so you guys get to see the Mordechai? Right, so the Mordechai was a little hard to find and a little hard to identify the key points. Sorry, right, it's in the back. It's just starts all over. Right, the whole Mordechai is after the Tosefta, but even within the Mordechai, this Mordechai is hard to find because in the first parak, but after he starts over again. So he has the whole Mosefta, and then he starts over again. And then we still need to pinpoint a line within it. So I'll just extract, in the interest of time, in the briefest possible way, the key point. And even within the discussion, there are two key points. In the interest of time, we'll focus on one. But Mordechai says that the Rashbam, Rashi's grandson, Shmuel ben Meir, the Rashbam wanted to do two things, and they would have been negative, and he was saved from them because of this klal of hashti behemtin shel tzaddikim, tzaddikim atzmo l'kol shekin. So the first one is a Hilchos Shabbos point. We'll skip it for now. The second point, just a little simpler, that, and a little more dramatic at the same time, that Mordechai tells the story that the Rashbam, he used to look down because he wanted to avoid seeing anything bad. So he would walk with his eyes down, and he was about to walk onto a carriage that was being pulled by kiloi behema, by animals that were not permitted to use together for work. So that would have been an isser. And he almost stumbled into it because he wasn't looking. So what happened? So his brother, Rabbeinu Tam, appears to him as a miracle, it says. And Rabbeinu Tam said to him, "Brother, al titztak harbe, don't be so frum that you don't look up and you think that you're not going to get into any problems. Look what you almost did. You're almost going to get yourself in a kiloyim situation." And he was saved from it. And this is apparently an example of behemtin shel tzaddikim and a kadosh baruch hu mevi takal. So what can you derive from this story?
It's a great Mr. Shmuz
on some level. Yeah, there's definitely something interesting, but for our student director, maybe?
I think that he was doing it out of, like, he wasn't doing it to be, like, holier than thou, but if he was, then he probably wouldn't have been saved. Because they're saying, like, The only reason he was saved from doing this is because he was a tzaddik.
See, that's an interesting point to bring up in general, right? Because there's a couple of layers to the story.
Yeah.
So, first of all, if the assumption is that this is a case of behemtin shel tzaddikim, so then what does that say about?
So it's not, was it his animals?
No, presumably.
Have
them focused on the behema word.
Yeah.
Right. But even without that part, let's be focusing. It's interesting also, but we're just focusing on the.
But it's happening to him, so that's even more.
Right. Let's focus on that part. But is this about achila? Okay,
no.
So Sam, yeah?
No.
So it sounds like this is not an achila case. So one can interpret that if the premise here is, or even after the fact, it sounds like the way that it's being described, is that this was a behemtin shel tzaddikim case. So then, apparently it's not only with an achila. In the previous example, which we didn't go into, but you can look at inside, the Hilchos Shabbos example is also not about achila. So the two cases there are not about achila. And it sounds like we're applying this principle. But it's interesting to note, Rav Gestetner points this out in his Sefer on Maseches Chulin, the Nos Imperial, that what about Rabbeinu Tam? Right, what's Rabbeinu Tam's shita on this issue?
He also says he also saves an achila.
Yes, he says it's also only limited to achila. Right, that's what we saw
later,
that from the Sefer Yashar.
Appeared to.
Oh, yeah.
Appeared to. Whoever this is, I don't know about her.
To his brother, to
his
Rashbam.
Brother, and it was, and I guess he brought up Behemtin shel tzaddikim, and that would seemingly be a contradiction to what we thought he said before.
Or maybe it's not a contradiction. Maybe it's a l'shitaso, right? Because maybe he's saying, "What are you doing here? You think you can just walk around with your eyes closed and rely on Behemtin Shul Sadiqim, no, it doesn't work.
I see.
Right?
If Forbidden Ritam didn't, I guess, appear, then he would have...
Right.
But the Mordechai said...
Didn't the Mordechai say it was an ace that he appeared also? So that would be Behemtin Shul Sadiqim.
But the Mordechai is interpreting
so many letters.
Exactly, right. You see, this is a fascinating story.
Mordechai is interpreting it to be the Shita Sa, but it seems like the mice itself, if you like look at it in the vacuum, it can maybe...
So maybe Ben Atam is Lushitaso, but maybe the Rashbam, and maybe to whatever extent this is being framed like this by others, that maybe it's the Machlokas there. Maybe Ben Atam is Lushitaso, so he shows up in this miracle to say, if you ask me, you can't rely on Behemtin Shul Tzadikim. But the other view here is that, yes, you could rely on it. So maybe it's a machlokas l'shitasim, that there are some Rishonim who say that there is a principle of Behemtin Shul Tzadikim by other Yisurim too. And Rebbeinu Tam is l'shitasim, saying, what are you doing?
Can we disqualify that idea that this concept could apply to other Averis, of all the examples of Rebbeinu making mistakes in the Shas?
No, well, we saw that there are other, we just mentioned the Ran, for example, but right? There are other approaches.
Would you call this case a case of Pshia? Or would you be able to call this case not a case of... Not a
maybe.
Case.
Or even if you don't have to take the Ran's distinction as the only distinction, it's just that we can infer from the Ran that he doesn't accept the Achilu distinction, so the Al-Shech probably also didn't. You know, you have different ways to answer the questions.
Right.
So it seems like a valid machlokas here about whether it's limited to Achilu or not.
Right. But then, I guess, how would you...
So you have other ways to answer. You could use the Ran's answer, or you could use other answers. You know,
could you use the Ran's answer?
Yeah. You could say that's what the Ben Atam was telling him, again, even though he doesn't need that answer.
Right.
He's saying that you're being negligent by walking around the street not looking where you're going.
Because if he was being negligent, then Ben Atam would have
appeared. Right, but you don't need Ben Atam's approach. But still, it could work. I mean, it doesn't matter which answer we use. You know, there could be other approaches. But what's fascinating here is that, as Levi was saying, you have layers here. So it seems like Rabbeinu Tam is speaking with Shitaso, saying, I don't think this is a good life strategy because you're not going to be protected. But the question is, ultimately, does he undo himself? Because by showing up and giving this message, so maybe he's disproving his own point. Or maybe the end result of the story is that the Rashbam was protected, even in this non-Achila situation. So this is discussed in the Nussan period there also, Rav Nussan Gestetner. And he notes that he thinks Rabbeinu Tam presumably agrees that there is a broader shmira and potential, that it's probably a likely reality that tzaddikim are often protected from even inadvertent mistakes in all areas. Rabbeinu Tam doesn't have to reject that absolutely. He's just saying when the Gemara invokes it as some kind of a given, that it's a definite fact, so that's midei da'achila, because there it's such a gnai, so you can take it as a given and invoke it in halachic arguments, that ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu mevi takal al yadayim. But doesn't mean to say that outside of this there's never any shmira. Yeah, it's not going to shock Rabbeinu Tam that his brother was zochet to Shmira and other Yisurim also. But when the Gemara invokes it as something as across the board an absolute, that's in terms of Midei Da'achila. So essentially, sometimes it'll happen and sometimes it won't happen with other cases. It's not going to, if you tell you after the fact that it happened, it doesn't have to contradict Rabbeinu Tam's position. You see, when the Gemara invokes it as a reliable rule, that's midei da'achila. But as a concept that's theoretically possible, that has a broader application.
Mordechai, when he says that here, is just saying that it's possible this is what could have happened. This could have just been like a case.
Yeah, he said, tzaddik had this instance of being saved from an inadvertent avera, and Rabbeinu Tam would agree that such a thing is possible and played a crucial role in the story. But what his comment in the Sefer HaYashar and the Ri's comment in Tosus is not to say that there's never any Shmira for other Averos. is saying that when the Gemara invokes it as some kind of a question, oh, how could it be that a tzaddik ended up eating something that was usur? So that's because it's about eating. So that's when you ask it as a question. But when it's not about mitzvah achila, Rabbeinu Tam will say, maybe there'll be shmir, maybe there won't. So if you tell me after the fact there was, I can accept that. It doesn't contradict anything. But those aren't the cases where we'll ask a kasha if it doesn't happen. Okay, so far so good. So there are a few other major points I want to make sure to cover about this, so just to go from point to point. So one major issue, if you saw the Taz today, it also connects into the theological question here. Are we talking about the tzaddikim in their own personal behavior, or are we talking about how they affect others' behavior? So here, it's interesting, what would you really think if I were to ask you? If I were to say there's a certain shmirah that a tzaddik's not going to be connected to a takala, is that takala in his own personal actions or in the actions of others that are connected to his instruction? What would you say?
Probably his own.
Okay, so why would you say his own?
Because again, going back to the whole parallel endeavor thing yesterday, I mean, that's like... That's having like everyone else, that's something that, they themselves may not be sinning, but they're causing everybody else to sin.
Okay, so I was wondering if you're going to say that, because it's an interesting point, because that's something to think about. But it's like a technical point, saying like, because the Torah addresses the consequences of a mistake in psak, so therefore it must be that this is only about personal behavior and not about psak. So essentially, for a textual reason, I feel like saying that. But if you didn't have that perspective from a more intuitive angle, how would you approach this question? Gilad, do you want to... So what would you think? What's more of a concern? Hi.
Well, I think the intuitive point, I would think it's not personal.
Okay, so you think that... But
Saudi goes about his life and he gets prevented,
But he's able to cause problems in other people's lives? It just seems like that's a bigger achrayah, like that's a bigger stain on the tzaddik, so to speak. Intuitively, it's a little surprising. And also, mystically, we do have this idea that poskim have a certain siyata d'shmaya in terms of their psak. Rav Shechter relates the story that the Chassam Sofer's son asked him, why does he, and this is brought in some other sparmosis, why does he respond so quickly to things that didn't seem like he was working so hard to make sure that he got all the proofs down, that he had more of a kind of instinctive attitude towards psak. I wouldn't say this is my own, but this is the way it's brought. So apparently the Chassam Sofer's response was that if everybody is coming to him with shailas, so then he must have a certain siyat d'shmaya in addressing them, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would protect the well-being of Klal Yisrael and the Mesorah, so that if he's the address that people are coming to, so then there's going to be a certain siyat d'shmaya as far as that's concerned. Sorry? Maybe Ruach HaKodesh, or maybe not going as far as Ruach HaKodesh, but like a certain assistance. It's still an intellectual process, but the process has a certain protection against egregious error. Rav Nasan Gestetner, again, another one of his farim, and it's the Lahoros Nasan on Pirkei Avos. He quotes that in the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. It says that, he quotes the story also, so about the Chassam Sofer. So it's not something I would take on my own to say, but it's you can find it in some places. But there he says that, why does the first Mishnah in Avos tell us the whole train of the Masorah? And Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mitzinai, I'm sorry, Yeshua, etc., etc., Lachik Nes Sagadola. And then the Mishnah ends, Heimam Rishlosh Dvarim, Hevi Mesunim Bedin, Behamidu Talmidim Harbe, Vesyus Yagwa Torah. It says, what's the connection between the first half of the Mishnah and the second half of the Mishnah? It says that once upon a time there was a clear address for the Masorah. Moshe Rabbeinu was the clear address for the Masorah. So, invoking that Chazam Sofer story anachronistically, to go back to Moshe Rabbeinu, so then you have a clear source where the Masorah is going to come from, and you can assume that there is a certain Siyata Dishmaya. But as you go later in the generations, it gets much more diffuse. It's not anymore one specific individual, but it's Talmidim of Talmidim of Talmidim of Talmidim. So you don't really know where the Masorah is housed. So then you have to be more careful. You have to rely more on Chachma and to get the right answer. And that's why those three statements in the Mishnah are all connected to that, that you should set up many students, and you should think very carefully, have a Masunim Bedin, and it's Yusyag LaTorah, you have to make a fence around the Torah, because it's more likely that there's going to be something wrong. So he interprets the whole Mishnah in that spirit. There's a story, I believe, they say about the Noda Behuda, that when the Noda Behuda was trying out for a rabbinical position, if I remember the story correctly, there was one person in the audience, in the community, who wanted to fashder him, who wanted to mess him up. So he made up, out of nowhere, a particularly challenging shaila, which wasn't really true, but he just made this up just to test him. And he came and he asked the shaila, and the Noda Behuda thought for a few minutes, and he said, "You're making this up, this isn't real." And eventually the person confessed, "Okay, fine, I made it up, how do you know?" And the Noda Behuda explained that, "I know when I address a real shaila, I have a certain siyata d'shmaya that I should get the answer right. And now I'm thinking about it, I'm not feeling any kind of divine assistance here. It must not really be nageil maisa. It must not really be a real issue." Okay, so there might be a certain greater logic of behemten shel tzaddikim when it comes to other people's behavior. So here, just source-wise, there's a paramachlokus about this, because the Taz, if you got a chance to see it, so the Taz addresses one technical question by suggesting that only when the tzaddik himself is engaging in the behavior do you have this logic. And others say the opposite. And the Aruch Liner, for example, in a few places, in his commentary to the Masechtas, and the Aruch Liner also discusses in his Tshuvas Ben Yitzion, that it's the opposite, that it's davka about where it happens to others, where the others are acting on his instruction. And the truth is, that itself might reconcile some of our contradictions, that maybe the Gemara davka in some cases is talking about that. That's particularly the prime case of Behemtim Shel Tzaddikim. So he's talking about Rav Pinchas Ben Yair's animal being fed unmeisered produce by someone else. So it's not necessarily about the tzaddik's own behavior in that case. So maybe source-wise and intuitively-wise, you might come to the opposite conclusion. And that also helps for the theological question we started with, because indeed, nobody's perfect and he's never going to sin. But maybe when there's a process that is genuine, so then maybe that there's a certain siyata d'shmaya to that, that other people are not going to be in a takala because of him. This is a point that Rav Shechter emphasizes a lot, that's why it's crucial that posek be a Yirei Shemayim and be somebody who's going through an honest process. And with that, there's a certain siyata d'shmaya that's going to come with that. And as far as personal behavior, so everyone can make mistakes. Hi.
A category is somebody doing an avera. He's doing the there, but it's affecting someone else.
So,
killing someone by accident.
Right, so then you also have to enter into all the above us considerations of divine justice and how that fits with their sources in Chazal also, say if somebody kills somebody, b'mezid, and wasn't punished for it, and somebody else killed somebody, b'shogeg, and wasn't punished for it, so then there's Magalga with Dvarim that this person ends up, the person killed the mezid ends up getting killed, et cetera, et cetera. So these cheshbonos are beyond us, but it's a part of the divine calculations that we don't fully understand, but we can imagine some kind of a framework. Hi.
In LA, there's that Marashat in Makos about Hashem working out for the person who killed, showing the person who killed the mezid.
Right, that's what we're alluding to. Yeah, so that's from Chazal. Yeah, that there's a divine framework there that can't really cheshbon out, but we can assume there's a pattern to it. So I also, as I mentioned yesterday, I wanted to call your attention to some of the lumdisher implications, which are very significant of this particular passage. This is a major discussion. I'm going to try to say it relatively quickly, and may still overflow a little bit into tomorrow. But this is definitely something you should be aware of just for your broader lumdisher knowledge and the implications of the sugya. So one of the questions I asked you to think about yesterday is it possible that some things are takalas and some things aren't? Right? That apparently what emerges from our Gemara is that an act or an avera could be a takala even though it wasn't committed intentionally by anyone. Because apparently the implication of our Gemara is that even though no one's trying to do anything wrong here, if the avera had happened, it would have been a takala, and a Kadosh Baruch Hu protects that from happening. And so it sounds like an avera, maybe even ba'ones, could still be something bad that we would call a takala. So I asked you yesterday, if that's true, is it true about everything? Or is it only true about some things? And are there some things that maybe it wouldn't be called a takala? So one distinction one might make is possibly between Isurim Darabanan and Isurim Daraisa. And this is a major, major discussion. I think we've alluded to it in past years or discussed it in greater length in past years. But there is a popular theory in Achronim, which I am giving very short shrift to right now, but just to say it briefly, that there's a fundamental difference between an Issur D'Oraisa and an Issur D'Rabbanan. That an Issur D'Oraisa could be called what's known in the Lamdisha terms as Asur B'Cheftza. Now let's say if somebody eats Chazer, so Chazer is Asur Min HaTorah, that is an objectively bad item, spiritually considered. So it's harmful. It's spiritually harmful to eat chazer. And maybe that's true even if you're not doing it on purpose. And the idea of a kapara for an avera b'shogeg may also connect to that notion that an isser d'oraisa is objectively harmful to you spiritually. And even if you didn't do it on purpose, and there's no point in punishing you, but there's still a kapara, there's still an atonement, because there's still a spiritual stain. So there are many who suggest it's based on a Nesivas HaMishpat and other sources, which take a longer time to explain, but there are those who suggest that when it's an Issur D'Rabbanan, it doesn't work like that. Because God wrote the Torah and God made the world, so he can say, okay, Chazer is objectively, spiritually harmful. But when the rabbis came and make a new din, so a chicken cheeseburger is asur midrabbanan, it's not that it was neutral until they came along, and now all of a sudden it took on spiritual harm. If it was neutral before they came along, it's neutral now too. And the authority of Chazal is not on objects. It doesn't create spiritual realities. It's on Jewish people. Jewish people are obligated to follow the dictates of Chazal, and they're not allowed to rebel against the dictates of Chazal. So if they would rebel against a rabbinic directive, that would be the wrong thing to do. But it wouldn't turn the item into anything spiritually harmful. So if a Jew would eat a chicken cheeseburger, he'd be doing the wrong thing because he'd be rebelling against Chazal's directive. But it doesn't turn the chicken cheeseburger into something inherently spiritually damaging. So many Achronim say, based on a comment of the Nesivos, that if somebody were to eat or commit an aveira d'rabbanan in general, b'shogeg, unknowingly, then there's no need for any kind of a kapara. And the explanation would presumably be that when you do an issa d'rabbanan, the real aveira is the act of rebellion. The item itself is neutral, only act itself is neutral. And if it was b'shogeg, there's no rebellion. So if there's no rebellion, so then there's nothing. There's nothing to fix because the item and the act itself was neutral.
Even
a Isser ben Adam l'chaveiro would have its own impact. It's not usually connected to Dinim D'Rabbanan for the most part. So it's a separate discussion. But let's say, let's focus for a second on something like Isser Achila. So that's how many would assume. Happens to be that Rabbi Yosef Engel, in his Asfin Daraisa, in Klal Yud, so he takes issue with this. He is not on the side of those that Achronim. And essentially, he believes that HaKadosh Baruch Hu signs on to whatever Chazal do. He brings a medrash to prove that point. So once the rabbis make their gezeros, so then, yes, the world changes. Rabbi Yosef Engel, he says that part based on a medrash. So one way in which he proves this is based on our Gemara. Because our Gemara applies this idea of Hemta and Shal Sadikim, among other things, applies it to Demai. Right, what is Demai? Demai is an Issa D'Rabbanan, where you have the possibility of tevel, of unmeisered food mixed in, and we're not sure. So Chazal asked it at Midrabbanan. So in that context, the Gemara says, oh, it couldn't be that somebody would eat demai in light of Eina Kersh Baruch Hu Mevitakal, that a tzaddik would eat demai. So says Yosef Engel, so you see here that even though it's an Issa D'Rabbanan, it's still called the Takala. See that it's not neutral. That it still takes on a negative status. And that even if it were to be consumed without any knowledge, that's still harmful. Everybody follow? And so that's a pretty fascinating point. Now, similar to this, he also quotes from the Shach in Yerideya that the Shach says that when it comes to children, so some Rishonim maintain that you're not obligated to stop your children from doing an Aveira D'Rabbanan. But the Shach says, but if they're going to eat something that's Treif Midrabbanan, you should still stop them because of Timtum Halev. So apparently he's assuming that even when there's an Issa D'Rabbanan involved, there's a Timtum Halev, that it's still something harmful. So that's a related point, but essentially that's what he says, that he thinks that even when there's a rabbinical prohibition only, it's still considered to be a Takala. And then he goes on to say that even if you want to agree with the Nesivos and say there's no Kapara necessary, but he says it's still possible that something might not need a kapara, but might still be a takala, at least for an Adam Gadol, and is therefore relevant to this discussion. But it's not neutral that the Issa D'Rabbanan does change what's happening in a fundamental way. Now, at one point, I don't think he addresses, and it's just also pretty fascinating, that this piece, Klal Yud in Asfin Daraisa, says this whole question of Isser Chefza and Isser Gavra, the idea that some things are usser in their essence, and some things, the essence is neutral, they're just prohibited. You're not allowed to do that. So he mentions two distinctions that Achronim draw, and he disagrees with both of them. So one is what we just mentioned, that some say Doraisas could be a Chafza Isser, but Rabbanans are only external, are only an Isser Gavra.
That Lashon of Gavra being external,
uh-huh.
That's consistent, that's always going to be like a Fulunet.
For this purposes, it means that it's not in the Chafza, it's not in the thing itself. So it's only about how you relate to it. So you're not allowed to eat this, but it's a neutral item. There's a prohibition on you to eat this neutral item. While if it was a Torah issue, it would say that this item is spiritually bad and you're not allowed to eat it. So we just said that he rejects that distinction. But the other distinction, which he also rejects, is that Charonim maintain that if something is only temporarily usur, then maybe also you have to say it's not usur b'chafza. Because it seems difficult to say that an item changes fundamentally from one day to the next. So, let's say a chametz and Pesach, we wrote up yesterday. So to say, which has its own sources, separate discussion, but to say that, 51 weeks a year, it's a neutral chafza. And then 1 week a year, it all of a sudden becomes bad b'chafza. So some felt that's hard to say. So Rabbi Svengel, for other reasons, he rejects that distinction also.
How do you define temporary? Like for Pikuach Nefesh, Yirat HaPinuch HaLa Shabbos, does that count, that whole?
So it's a good question, because that brings up another issue, which we'll have to overflow into tomorrow, because I do want to talk about that. But let's not say your personal circumstances, but let's just say the overall circumstances. Let's say Chametz on Pesach, or food on Yom Kippur, or the like. So he rejects both distinctions. He says that the Rabbanans can be an Isser Chafza, and temporary Yisurim can also be an Isser Chafza. However, yeah.
Wait, what about Shuma for a non-Kohen?
So you mean something that's only, it's another interesting distinction, if it's only for some people and not for others. Right, that's also something, it's a worthwhile discussion too. He talks about Truma there also in the end of the piece. But that's, it's got its own dimensions to it. But he's putting these two together, that he rejects both distinctions, Deraisa Drabbanan and temporary versus permanent. But it's interesting to note that as far as the Takala proof is concerned, our Tosfos in Chulin treats those two distinctions separately. Right? Because Tosfos doesn't just talk about the Raisas Rabbanans, but assuming it's the Gemara is talking about Demai, so apparently putting those parts together, the assumption is the Rabbanan could be called a Takala also. But Tosfos distinguishes when he says something that even though Midei Da'achila are normally the primary examples of a Takala, but if you recall, we saw yesterday, Tosfos says, but if it's something that's mutter, but it's just prohibited right now, that's different. It's a temporary issue. So you have to figure out how exactly that plays out. Just parenthetically, this influences the whole question mentioned a few minutes ago, let's say about the Shach, because the question comes up, for example, how do you feed children, little children, on Yom Kippur? If you can't feed your little children pork, and you can't feed your little children chametz on Pesach, so how come you can feed them on Yom Kippur? So chametz on Pesach is going to be a complicating example, but let's say pork versus Yom Kippur. So it might be that when something is only usher today, but it's inherently okay, that doesn't fall into the same kind of category. Poskim discuss this also. We have a widespread practice. You make Kiddush and Shul Friday night, so the one making Kiddush generally can't drink because he has to wait for Makum Suda. So the practice is in many places to give Ketanim to drink. So the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch ask, how could you do that? You can't feed the Ketan non-kosher food. How can you give him wine before Makom Suda? So one explanation is that no, there's nothing wrong with the wine, except according to American law, because he's a cotton, but that's a different point. But there's nothing wrong with the wine inherently, it's just the wrong time. So that doesn't enter into the same kind of category. So this is a very prominent example of the usage of this sugya in Lomdus, in a very broadly applicable lumdish point. in a different piece, Rav Yosef Engel uses this in a more narrow lumdish point. So God willing, we'll have to start with that tomorrow. And I want to discuss Yossi's point about Pikuach Nefesh also, because that has some ramifications. Also wanted to connect this to this past week's Kriya Satoru, so we have a little bit that we have to pick up with tomorrow, but hopefully we'll try to get that done in the beginning so that we can go into Chazara immediately from that point. We also have to partially because we have a lot of stuff to do, so let's hopefully try to get that done as soon as possible. Okay, everybody good? All right, so I will look forward to seeing you tomorrow.